aluminum knife.
Da-da-da-da.
I did it the way you wanted me to do it this time.
And I wasn't even going to call it out, but yes, you did, and thank you. Because the way I like it is right.
I keep you surprised.
That indeed.
Don't expect it to be this way forever.
Oh, I would never.
Because one day I may surprise you.
Yeah, oh no.
I may cut it off in mid-la-la.
You will.
I may not even wait for that last fade-out, but you will cut that off. Cut it off in the middle of the la-la-la.
You will eventually disappoint me.
That's daily. I will daily disappoint
you. That's something I've grown to count on.
I will ruin something each day of your life. I will ruin something of your life every day of your life.
You are King Midas of the universe.
And that is how I will show love.
That's right.
That's
how we roll.
Each moment of your existence. It'll be a never-ending, like, you know, suspense-filled day for you. Like, what will he destroy or make or muck up?
You are Dave White of Movies.com and Destroyer of Worlds.
Hang on, I'm looking at your face. Is that your glasses fogged up? Is that what's going on with the...
Yeah, because of the, I'm sweating a little.
Oh, it's but the compress is what.
Yes, that too.
All right.
And I'm Alonzo Duralde. The Rap and What the Flick.
I'm Dave White. You're Alonzo Duralde.
And ow, my eye!
This is Linoleum Knife, a podcast of the cinema.
Yes, it is.
And you have an eye. You have a problem with your eye.
I have an eye problem.
You have a serious, and ugly and gross problem with your eye.
Mm-hmm. I have a corneal abrasion.
Everyone keeps asking me how this happened.
Well, I'll explain it. I wore contact lenses for years and never, ever scraped up my eye. But I've done it now because I'm old. I'm old.
I don't understand.
Things in my body that are supposed to be moist are now dry.
Tell me what the ophthalmologist said to you. Because I'm confused.
That I'm dry.
You're dry in your eyeballs.
I'm dry, like Joan Rivers was cited at Stern's.
No.
My eyes are dry.
All right.
So what happens is apparently there are goops that are supposed to be on the surface of the eyeball, and yes. Because I am dry, and because it's been hot,
is
and
it
we've
because
had,
of the age,
we've had the ceiling. But yeah, I think
I'm 3 years older than you.
Well, it hits people at different times.
Does it happen to everybody?
I don't know. It's hitting me now. Anyway, it's been hot here, so we've had the ceiling fan going as we sleep. We've been sleeping under that, and it has made the goops that should be at the surface of my eyeball stick to the inside of my eyelid. Which is why many mornings when I wake up, my eye feels like some awful thing has landed inside of it and hurts like the dickens.
Yeah.
I kept thinking that the fan was somehow blowing like big gobs of lint into my eyes or something. Cause it,
that's cause what I figured,
too. I would get up in the morning and it would hurt, and I would do the eye wash and it would do nothing. And then eventually it would feel better. And then one day it didn't feel better, and I had to go to Kaiser because it hurt so dang much. And it turned out that my soothing eyeball goops were sticking to my eyelid and being scraped off, and so now I have a corneal abrasion.
Is this forever?
No. Well,
I mean,
the dry part, I don't know. But part of how I'm going to fix that is that I'm now taking flaxseed oil.
The flaxseed oil.
To make me juicy, to give me like a good shiny coat, and it's supposed to be good for my skin and hair as well as for my dry eyeballs. And warm compresses also are
every day.
Yes. But for right now, cold compresses on the affected eye, because it's the only thing that makes it not hurt.
But it looks like it's getting better.
It does.
Like, two days ago, it looked like the strain worm was going to come out of here.
I
kept kind of waiting for that to happen.
Like, you'll notice that I'm sitting here with both...
Sitting next to you on the couch, hoping that the strain worm
I know
would
you
come
were really hoping
eyeball.
For that, but I started to disappoint. You'll notice that I actually have both eyes open right now. I'm not like...
Yeah, you do.
...slamming one shut. So it is getting better, I think.
Thing.
Another day or so of this.
Here's what I don't understand about this healing process.
What's that?
Remember when I was a school teacher back in Texas in the 90s?
Uh-huh.
And that's what I was, by the way. Y'all knew people. Back in the 90s, I was a middle school teacher in Texas.
It's true.
And I was really good, too. Mm. I was really good at being a middle school teacher. But one day I was handed back some papers, and I flipped a paper off the top of the stack. I know.
Worst story ever.
Let's just say that what happened next involved my eye.
And the sharp corner of a piece of paper.
Yeah. And I had to... First of all, I said a swear. My kids were always swearing in class. And then I had to get the someone to come, I walkie-talkied a person to come up to the room to take the class.
Right.
So that I could run and...
to the ER.
Down to my car and drive to the ER.
That they nobody drove you.
No. Well, my principal said, let me find someone who can take you. And I was like, I'm going right now.
No time.
No time for this.
Depth perception is overrated.
And it gets better. Like, after they treated me and fixed me up, here's the part I don't understand. They put gunk in my eye, and then they put a bandage over my eye.
Right.
And then they put a patch over the bandage.
Right.
And I had to stay that way, if you recall, for like 3-4 days.
Mm-hmm.
And then they took it off.
Mm-hmm.
Why did I have to do that and you not do that?
Perhaps my abrasion is different than your slice?
It was a slice.
Or maybe this is as much love as I'm going to get from Kaiser? I don't know.
That's what I think. I just think about how cruddy our health insurance is.
Yeah,
I mean, we're lucky we have health insurance.
At all, yes.
But... But I just think about what garbage they are most of the time. And that's the part I don't understand.
I'm mending. That's what matters.
And I'm very glad about that because I was worried there for a couple of days.
Yeah.
I thought, what if his eyeball falls out?
What about all the 3D movies?
And then I thought, but then he'd have this cool bionic eyeball after that. Like, yeah. So then I wasn't so worried about that.
I don't think you get bionic eyeballs.
You don't?
I think you get glass.
They don't make bionic ones yet?
I don't think so.
I think they do.
Maybe not. I don't think the public sector
has. It's the future.
I think only super secret, like, you know, military science robots have them.
But you're a very important film critic. I think they would give one to you.
Although, you know, I think glass eye technology has gotten better in that it tends to, like... look in the right direction, you know?
I don't know.
Like, you watch some of those old Sandy Duncan clips or Sammy Davis Jr., and it's kind of like, oh, I can tell.
It would just kind of roll around.
Yeah, and now I think it's a little more focused, as it were.
Well, I don't know. Do we know anybody that only has one functioning eye that... I don't know that we know anyone.
I don't know. But you know what? Maybe...
If we don't know them,
perhaps
if
we do,
don't know it, then maybe that proves
exactly.
Your point.
That's what I'm saying. It's stuff.
So the my story has a really good happy ending.
Oh well, yeah, it's true.
Yeah, because I went back to the doctor and they tested me, and the doctor said, "So you've healed up very nicely." And I said, "Thank you." And he said, "Did you know you have 20/10 vision?" And I said, "Oh no." I thought, "Oh no, my eyesight has been damaged because 20/20." Is what you're supposed to have. And I thought that meant that I had ruined myself somehow. And he said, do you know what 20/10 means? And I said, no. He said, it means you're Superman.
Yes, that story is not quite as braggy as it used to be.
Now,
now that you now have,
that
to
I
wear,
have to wear glasses now, yeah.
Wearing you know, them cheaters.
That was almost 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Now I'm 50.
Now you're old.
Now I'm 50 and I have to wear reading glasses.
I will
much all the time.
I will always be blind.
I no longer have 20/10. I no longer even have 20/20.
Yeah, I will always be blinder than you, but you are no longer super eyes.
I used to be Superman with my eyeballs.
Yeah. I've been wearing glasses since fourth grade. Yeah.
Well. Yeah, but it's part of your thing that like your mnemonic is your glasses. Specifically the glasses you've worn for the past almost 20 years.
Yeah, it's
this
funny.
One kind of glasses.
I
that has gone in and out of style.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I think the hipsters have moved on, thankfully. Leave me alone. I remember one time back in Dallas when I was running the film festival, I would switch out, and some nights I would wear contact lenses, and some lady actually kind of pulled me aside and said that I should just wear my glasses, that it looked better.
Really?
Yes.
Well, she's right.
So, you know.
You have a great normal face without the glasses. like when you're sleeping and you don't have your glasses on, I just think, look how cute he is. And then I think, I can't wait till he wakes up and puts on the glasses.
You're crazy. Heavens.
We have movies to talk about.
We do, indeed.
We're going to talk about A Walk Among the Tombstones.
Right.
And This Is Where I Leave You. Mm-hmm. Tusk.
Yep.
The Maze Runner.
Yep.
Space Station 76.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't even know what this other one is. I didn't see Space Station 76, so that's going to be you talking about that by yourself.
And I also saw...
You saw something else with Ryan Phillippe. I don't even know what it is.
Reclaim?
Reclaim.
Right.
Tell me about Reclaim, because I don't...
Okay, sure. We'll knock that one off quickly.
Did it open in a movie theater?
It has... Lionsgate has been doing this thing of late where they do like a kind of a cursory theatrical opening. It'll open in a few markets, on a few screens, and then they mainly are selling it as a VOD movie. So wherever you are, you can watch Reclaim right now.
Does that mean they don't have confidence in the film? Does that mean they think it's not good enough?
I don't know. I don't know.
Do they get stars people that can't open a movie under any circumstances?
It's weird. It's a tier that I don't fully understand, because I've seen a whole variety of films. Like, there was a movie called Burning Blue. It was this like sort of gays in the military drama that had no real names in it.
Right.
But then this one has, you know, Ryan Phillippe
and
John Cusack and Rachel Lefevre and Jackie Weaver, and like, you know, names that you kind of know.
They're names you know, but they're not, well, except for Rachel Lefevre. I don't know who she is.
She was like in the first Twilight movie, and then it was a big hoo-ha because she didn't come back for the other Twilight movies.
Why didn't she come back?
She got another gig somewhere.
Oh, so she works somewhere that we don't know about.
Yeah.
Like on some TV show or something.
I forget what the other gig was, but yeah, she walked out.
I'm just going to look her up right now while you tell me.
Yeah, but I mean, I've seen some good movies in this. I mean, like, that's how they released this comedy called Date and Switch that I thought was really funny.
What was that?
That was the one about the high school comedy about the two best friends who, like, their big thing is they're going to lose their virginity on prom night, and then one of them comes out to the other one. The sort of the chunky Seth Rogen-y one comes out to the other one.
Oh, was this the one that was originally called Gay Dude?
Yes.
It was shooting under the title Gay Dude.
Gay Dude, right.
And then
it was
changed,
released as Date and Switch.
It changed to some generic name that no one would ever remember.
Pretty much, yeah. But despite the generic title...
That was brilliant of them to do that.
Yeah. But it was a very funny movie, I thought. And one worth...
I still haven't seen it. I remember you talking about this.
There
was an episode where you talked about it.
Yeah, and you kind of walked through the room while I was watching it, and you chuckled at a few things, so... You know.
I don't remember that at all.
Like, it has, and the supporting cast has, like, you know,
Rachel Lefevre
has
is on the show Under the Dome.
Okay.
And
I can't remember. Nick Offerman, and
she was in Homefront.
And
she
Gary
was
Cole.
In White House Down.
Okay.
She was in some show called A Gifted Man. That's all I know. She was in two of the Twilight movies.
Okay. Anyway, Reclaim. So Rachel Lefevre and
Ryan Phillippe
play this American couple, and they want to adopt this adorable little girl who was orphaned during the Haitian earthquake.
Okay.
And so they go to, I want to say it's, the movie was shot in Puerto Rico. I can't remember if they say specifically
in the
movie.
Is that the Wycliffe Jean earthquake?
Yes, that one.
The one where he raised a lot of money and then they figured the money didn't go to where it was supposed to go.
I believe that's...
Something like that. Yes. Am I saying something incorrect?
That sounds right, but...
Am I completely incorrect about that?
Why don't you Google that, and if you're wrong, we'll go back and erase it. Anyway, so Jackie Weaver is their, like, sort of, you know, their kind of adoption pimp, and... you know, they meet the girl and she's lovely, and they get a couple of days to sort of bond together at this resort while Jackie Weaver sorts out setting up her passport. And then, like, John Cusack is also staying at the resort, and he's immediately exuding all kind of bad vibes. And after a couple of days, the little girl disappears, and they figure out that they have been scammed. This is the thing where they, like, scam rich, you know, like, do-gooder Americans who want to adopt older kids out of crisis zones. And they basically just, like, set up the same girl over and over again. And then it's this whole thing of, you know, can they rescue her? Can they get her back? Will they survive themselves? And blah, blah, blah. And It's the kind of movie where, you know, someone's being scammed, and at first you have sympathy for them, but then they keep doing stupid stuff, and after all, like, okay, you have this coming to you. Right. Like why you never called a lawyer, ever, you know, things right. like that. It just, you sort of lose patience with it.
According to Time magazine, yes. The Wyclef Jean charity, there are questions. apparently some of the money did go to the right places, and apparently some of it went to strange places that no one can seem to really figure out. And then the news about it just sort of stops around 2012.
Huh, interesting.
So who knows what happened.
So this movie is just, it's kind of routine. And, you know, it's the sort of movie where at the very end of the film, they put a title on the screen, something like, over 1.2 million children are trafficked each year.
And if you're against that, you tell people to go see this movie.
Yeah, and so it's like, well, that doesn't...
This film is against human trafficking.
That doesn't retroactively make your movie not stupid because you are telling us about an awful thing in the world. Sorry.
If you don't like this movie, you're pro...
child human. Trafficking.
You're pro child trafficking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's just, I mean, it's not even like howlingly terrible.
Does someone
just
try to traffic the child during the film?
Well, I mean,
did you just say that while I was looking up Wyclef
Jean? Well, the idea stuff? Is they keep sort of fake putting her up for adoption.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Which I don't know if that counts as trafficking, but
I don't
you know
what it does.
So, yeah, it is a lot of meh.
Great.
Yippah.
Another feather in Ryan Phillippe's cap.
Well, he's on the new, like, some Shonda Rhimes show, I think, now.
Oh, is he? Good for him.
I think he's on How to Get Away with Gloria Murder, or whatever that show is called. Well, you came up with a name for her. There's all these billboards in L.A. with Viola Davis on it, so How to Get Away with Murder. And we thought the show would be better if her name was Murder.
Yeah, Roxanne Murder. Roxanne is Murder. Is what I said her That's name it. Should be.
Roxanne Murder.
I would like it. I don't know what that show is about.
No idea.
But I would like it if her name was Roxanne Murder.
Yes, I would watch.
And she went around murdering one person every week and almost getting caught, but not getting caught because she knows how to get away with murder.
And her defense would be, just because my name is Murder.
Right. And then she would always be able to say, just because my name is Roxanne Murder, you think I'm the murderer?
Once again, Roxanne Murder walks free.
Right. And if you dare to cross her, you're... Her name phobic.
I think he's on that show, or he's on some show. I don't know.
I want him to be on a show. I want him to be.
You want him to be on Selfie.
I want him to be on Selfie.
Just because
he's not on How to Get Away with Murder.
He's on something.
Damages in 2012.
I thought he was on some new show on
Secrets and Lies. Is that a new show that's coming on?
I don't know. You're the looking at his IMDb.
I'm looking at his IMDb. I don't see any...
Is Secrets and Lies a television show?
Yeah, it looks like it.
Well, then.
Yeah. But the pilot, it just says there's a pilot. Right. So. I just, you know, I worry that Reese Witherspoon has blacklisted him somehow.
You know...
Because you know she's powerful.
Well, exactly.
I walked through the CAA building one day. I don't remember why I was in the CAA.
The Death Star?
Yes. That is the CAA.
On Avenue of the Stars?
Yeah. Why was I there?
Probably for a screening.
Oh, that's right, because they have that little screening room up at the top.
Well, they have one off the lobby, too.
The one I had to go to was... That building's impossible to walk around in.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
You have to go into one building and then sort of cross over... into the other one, and the elevators are different. Like, you can't
forget,
get to one side
forget parking
from
there.
The other. I know.
$35.
I know.
$35.
To park there.
So I was there for like 2 hours.
I walked through the lobby, because I'm on the way to the screening of whatever movie it was. And she's there in the lobby. Surrounded by people. Like, people who clearly work there.
Nabobs, yes men?
People who... were
flunkies,
like wearing nice office-y kind of clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she's in some jeans or whatever. Like, she's casual, but yeah. They're all dressed up. And I thought, it takes like 17 of you to tend to her.
It's like one holding her no foam cappuccino.
Hoisting her on a little platform.
Palanquin.
So, yeah.
Somebody else had her.
It was really weird. I noticed it. I thought, oh, there's Reese Witherspoon, and then I thought, look at all those people standing around Reese Witherspoon. What's being said? Like, I couldn't get close enough to overhear the conversations. I wanted to, of course.
She will crush us all.
I just thought it was funny.
So she's quite possibly crushed Ryan Phillippe's career.
I just in my head, I think, what has she done to him? Like, has she? She prevented him from getting jobs and stuff.
Well, in any event, we are, you know, we're not team Ryan Phillippe, but we support his
continuing efforts. Me being entertained by stuff.
Sure.
So if that's, you know.
He gets endless points in my book for playing the gay teenage swimmer on One Life to Live back in the 90s. That was the first thing he did.
I don't know about this at all.
Oh, man, that was like his first role. That was I started taping this soap every day.
Like on VHS tape.
On VHS tape in the early 90s because Billy...
His character name was Billy. How do you remember this?
Because it was a big deal.
Oh, okay.
This was back when, like...
Where was I?
This was back when there were so few gays on television. Like, 1991. Like, before I moved here the first time.
All right.
And so, yeah, so he came out of the closet and was getting, like, counseling from the local, like, you know, minister guy who was, like, all liberal. But then the girl who was...
Trying to touch him.
No, that's the thing. No. But the girl who was in love with the minister guy and he was, like, not having it started spreading this rumor that he was trying to touch him. And it was a whole thing. All culminating in the arrival...
That sounds really exciting.
All culminating in the arrival of the AIDS quilt.
Oh, good.
In Landview. And I wept. It was an amazing run on that show.
Did the quilt come because of him?
Well, the minister guy had a brother who died of AIDS, and then he had the hard-ass military dad who didn't want to acknowledge it and get it.
That poor quilt.
And then the quilt comes, and the dad cries, and
I feel sorry for the quilt being used for such
Billy comes
mawkish
out to his
purposes.
It was TV history.
All right.
We're jaded now about gays being on every channel at all the time.
Yes.
But in 1991, having a gay teenager, pretty young Ryan Phillippe...
I'd like there to be fewer gays on
television. On a soap opera.
Frankly.
Was a huge honking deal.
Every time a new gay is on television, I just think, you again. Because it's always the same guy. It doesn't matter who's playing him, it's always the same guy.
That's not necessarily true.
What? Name the exception.
The Sarah Silverman program.
All right. What else?
The guy on Archer.
All right, yeah.
So that's three right there.
Two stoners and an evil villain.
And he's not an evil villain.
Okay, you're right, he's not an evil
villain. Tig on the Sarah Silverman program.
All right. Tig and I were on the same...
Oh, that's right.
Bill on the KCRW show.
That's right.
So we've shared a stage.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
I am, in fact, on the same episode with
her. Of the show, yeah.
Yeah, when they broadcast the episode, it was me.
Of Unfictional.
And Tig.
And Susan Orlean.
So the three of us are tight now.
Mm-hmm. Those weekends on the Copped on TV.
Right.
Yeah.
I didn't meet her at all.
No.
Like, I didn't even see her in the green. Like, she showed up so late.
Uh-huh.
I had already gone on. Mm-hmm. And was already back sitting in a seat in the audience.
And by the time your set was done, like, they didn't let you back in the green room.
I didn't have a set. I had a 7-minute story. But, yes. And then after the show, she was not around. She showed up. She popped in, like, for her 7 minutes and then left. I'm sure she had some actual paying gig.
Yeah, she's not going to linger for public radio.
But I did talk to Susan Orlean that night, and she was very, very nice.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't think I knew this.
She was really nice.
That's cool.
And tiny.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone in that place was tiny, except for Rob Delaney.
I was going to say,
he's a big, tall dude.
Yeah.
But everyone else was little, and, you know, I look like Sweetums.
It's the magic of radio.
Yeah. All right, so you saw Reclaim, yes. And then we both saw A Walk Among the Tombstones.
Well, you know, you keep bearing the lead here. Like, the Maze Runner, like, we had a conversation, we were like, no one's going to see that. And I said, no, it's the number one movie this weekend. It's all a right. huge...
Do you want to talk about The Maze Runner?
Let's talk about The Maze Runner.
All right.
Even though it's stupid.
I...
Well, okay, it's not stupid until it's stupid.
Yeah, it's not... Exactly. Like, it
starts off kind of like, all right, what's
going on?
It
starts off typical in terms of, you know, someone within the first 15, 20 minutes says to the main teen boy, played by Dylan O'Brien, who's on Teen Wolf,
mm-hmm.
You're not like the others.
Yes.
You're curious.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know...
Because it's always got to be the specialist teen who upsets the apple cart.
That always is. That's the template.
The photogenic messiah, as I said in my review on the rap.
It's this.
He takes this.
We don't know that it's a dystopian future. We just know that it's a mystery.
Yes, and it's a YA adaptation, which means dystopian future is
yes.
right a strong
bet. Right around the corner. He is sort of belched up.
Yeah,
from the bowels of the earth.
He wakes up on a freight elevator with no memory of who he is.
Up, and so deep he can't see the bottom of the thing.
Depositing him in the middle of this leafy, what is it, the glade?
A grassy square.
Yeah.
It's fairly big.
With woods and walls, and the walls open up to reveal a maze.
That changes direction every night.
Yes.
You can hear it shifting in the night.
But despite the fact...
Entirely populated by teenage boys.
Right.
Who have set up their own society.
Yes.
Where there are rules and there are, you know, roles for everybody to play and functions and jobs.
It's a politer Lord of the Flies.
Well, it is the polite Lord of the Flies.
Right.
Like, there's no... Everyone's happy.
Well, there's a little dissension in the ranks.
They're not happy, but they're not, you know, trying to
kill each other.
And so then here comes whatever his name is. Thomas is mm-hmm. his name. And no one knows why they were put there. No one has any memory of the past. Their memories have all been erased.
One of them pops up every month.
A new one comes up every month
with supplies.
Supplies. And then when Thomas finds out that the people are, you know, running the maze every day trying to map it so maybe they could possibly get out.
He wants in.
He wants to do that. And they don't want him to do that. But so he does it anyway. He starts running the maze.
And he saves the life of a runner by helping defeat this weird maze monster that is part organic and part robot.
Yeah, it's like a giant mechanical spidery monster thing.
Yeah. So then after that happens, they send up a girl.
A girl, yeah.
With a note clutched in her hand that says, "This is the last one."
Kaya Scodelario.
She was on Skins.
Yeah.
And her name is Teresa, and she and Thomas vaguely have some memory of each other, but aren't
entirely
sure why.
But they don't know why they remember each other.
Anyway, so yeah, when
and there is this nice tension happening throughout the entire story because it's a mystery. You don't know why any of this is happening.
Yeah,
and they piece you out bits of information here and there, in a way that
is compelling,
keeps you interested. So for the first. You know, 90 minutes or so, you're thinking, all right, how are they going to ruin this? Because so far, I'm not having a bad time.
Right.
How will they ruin this? I want you to begin timing 60 seconds.
Go, we're going to talk spoilers now?
Because we're going to tell everyone what happens.
Okay.
You count 60, you start counting 60 seconds on the clock.
All right.
At that point,
you say when,
I will say when.
Okay.
And then, if y'all don't want to hear what happens,
zip ahead 1 minute.
Zip ahead exactly 60 seconds, and we will be done. And you can give me like a 30 second and a 15 second left situation. All right.
All right.
All right. Everybody, get your hand on the volume if you want to turn it down. Not hear how this ends, because how it ends is sequel.
Yes.
Because it's made up. Slow to money this weekend, and it's gonna make they're gonna make another one,
mm-hmm.
and it's based on a series of novels.
Yes, and which means eventually they'll have to get to the last book and turn that into two movies.
Yeah. All right.
Say when.
When.
Go.
Okay. So they break the maze, and then they get out, and they get whisked off in a helicopter by these guys in, you know, military clothes, and brought to a facility where Dr. Patricia Clarkson shows up and says, "Hello, everyone. I am Dr. Patricia Clarkson. Here's what's been happening to you this entire time."
You've got it kind of backwards, but go on.
"Everyone sit down and let me tell you the story of what we've been doing all this entire time. The dystopian future happened, and the diseases killed everyone, and we're going to cure the disease, and we have to use teenagers to test the disease, and we test you with the maze and the monsters. Why? Because. And now we're going to enter phase two.
15
the
seconds.
End." And you don't... It's
actually, they get the Patricia Clarkson video first, then the helicopters.
Whatever.
Whatever, same difference. So, yeah, that's,
they
you know,
explain everything to you.
But also not in a way that's remotely satisfying.
Is the 60 seconds
and
up?
Done. Okay, so
okay,
we're back.
So the 60 seconds is up.
So, yeah, so this movie is, it just becomes another sort of YA Mad Lib, basically.
Yeah.
And, I got some listener cranky from on What the Flick for suggesting that, like, you know, a movie that is set entirely in a colony of teenage boys might address the, you know, British boarding school sexual tension situational.
Oh, you talked about that on What the Flick.
Yeah, well, actually, Ben brought it up, and I kind of yes-anded him. And
but because you yes-anded him, and
yes,
you're the gay.
Of course, I made it gay!
It's you not Ben Mankiewicz,
right,
did this, right.
But anyway, that...
Ben Mankiewicz that's thinking about gay sex all the time. You can tell him I said that.
But that aside, yeah, this is, you know, it's...
Even when the girl shows up, there's no hint of...
No.
Of sexual anything.
Nothing.
Yeah.
You know, it is competently put together. It's well shot. You know, it looks pretty cool. Once it's all revealed, I could not care less, which means I'm going into the sequel super not interested.
It's
in
very loud.
What's next? Oh, it is so loud. I actually wrote down bowel rattling Dolby
it
in my notes.
It is very loud. So if you're going to see it, maybe you should see it in a theater where the sound is sort of turned down for olden people.
Yeah. Well, and of course, you know, they've got this thing now. It's showing in about a dozen theaters nationwide in this new Barco 270 degree vision. Have you seen this?
What does that mean?
It's basically Cinerama. They brought
back. Really?
Yeah, there's the center screen, but there's also sort of a left screen and a right screen.
Is this happening in Los Angeles?
It is.
Where?
Out at the Bridge.
You know, oh, really?
Yeah, the deluxe, whatever.
Oh, that's where they have the soda machines.
Yes, that one.
The 100-flavor soda machines.
Yes. Much more exciting than this new process.
I am enticed now.
Apparently, like, the first 15 minutes of the movie, they're showing in this sort of extra-wide process.
Only the first 15 minutes?
I think so, yeah.
Well, what's the point?
Well, the thing is...
Because then after the 15 minutes, you're like, and now we'll go back to the regular movie.
I don't know that... I don't think anybody has shot a film with that in mind yet.
Mm.
So I think that it's... You can't just be chopping up a movie and widening out when you feel like it, you know. Sort of like when those 3D post-conversions. Versions, you know, so I'll be interested to see how that thing works. When
will the first film in Rondo Vision
exactly,
come along?
When somebody shoots one, and when it's not the Maze Runner. But, you know.
Let's go see a movie where we're constantly having to turn our heads back and forth to see what's going on.
Did you ever see a Cinerama movie at the Dome?
Yes.
That's right. Yeah, we saw The Brothers Grimm.
We saw This Is Cinerama.
Oh, did you go with me to that? Okay,
Dome,
I couldn't remember. But you didn't go with me to see
I went to see with you to see the Brothers Grimm.
Yes,
as well.
Right, and yeah, it is definitely in you know, turno head vision.
But you sit far back enough from an actual Cinerama film, and you don't have to
turn
your head. But if this is an actual semicircle of a screen,
yeah,
I don't understand how that's supposed to.
It always reminds me.
How's that supposed to be fun?
When I was a kid at Disney World, they always had the Monsanto 360 vision.
Right.
You know, and you would go in a room and it was all around you, and they would, you know,
yeah,
through the velt or whatever, you know, and show all the stuff. That's what I always think of. But
and they sprayed you with a fine chemical mist while you were in there
to delouse you.
Yeah.
So yeah, Maze Runner. Whatever. Before we talk about Walking in the Tombstones, do we want to mention our gracious and generous sponsor?
We have a gracious and generous sponsor. The sponsor of Linoleum Knife for the next two or three episodes, I can't remember now.
I think we have this one and next one.
All right. Is the forthcoming feature film,
mm-hmm.
I Was a Teenage Were-Skunk.
Yes. we're actually being sponsored by that movie's Kickstarter campaign.
Yeah.
So that movie can happen.
They're spending money on sponsorship to get you to spend money on them.
It takes money to make money.
That is correct.
Or as Green on Red once sang, it takes money to make money, they say. Ain't it funny how love doesn't work that way? It sounds better when they sing it.
I don't know that it probably does. I'm not sure of that.
Anyway, they have wisely...
Grandpa, what was Green on Red?
They were rootsy. They have wisely invested in this program as a way
to kick up some starters.
Exactly.
For their movie.
To start kicking.
It is a comedy horror film, like old drive-in monster movies of the 50s.
An homage.
Apparently it is set in... They sent us a copy that I've been reading the past couple weeks, but I'm just going to go off script today.
Why not?
Because if you listen to this show regularly, you don't want to hear me read you the copy every week. You know, old drive-in, you know, monster movies of the 50s, science fiction, teens battling space monsters and things like that.
Movies that Roger Corman built a
career. I was a teenage were-skunk is the story of a boy named Curtis Albright. He does the 50s kind of things. He goes to malt shops and he drives around his car. Yeah. And thank you for that soundtrack, Green on Red. And
I was trying to go. I was going more for an identical feel.
The well, that's sing it. Come on, come on, Alonzo, sing me a little bit of boogie woogie rock and roll, will you?
Dance, dance, dance! Everybody's doing it. A boogie woogie rock and roll.
All right. So one night, teen Curtis Albright is being a sexual voyeur.
Yes. In a charming and innocent way,
he's
sure.
He's being a peeping teen. Mm. There is no charming way to stare at a naked person through their window without them knowing
The youthful hijinks and goings-on and
there's
whatnot.
A neighbor lady undressing for bed, and a skunk gives him what he deserves.
A mystical skunk.
An enchanted skunk.
Enchanted skunk.
Sprays him in the face, and he the result is that whenever he gets turned on,
aroused,
he turns into a murderous were-skunk.
Mm-hmm. And Dave incidentally raised the issue of, did Morning Wood count as skunk-inducing arousals? And
it probably does.
The director left an article on the Linoleum Knife Facebook page.
Oh, that's right.
Explaining the difference. So he's given this thought. Clearly, a great deal of research went into this ripped from the headlines saga. So
anyway,
he knows
his stuff. So the point is, this will be a fun film. And they need your money. And if you've got $1 or $5 or $10 or $15 or $15 million, you need to give it to the Kickstarter.
And they have...
I was a teenage were-skunk.
They have a whole bunch of levels of stuff and
you get things,
goodies.
Yeah.
So check out teenagewereskunk.com. That's T-E-E-N.
Say it again.
T-E-E-N-A-G-E-W-E-R-E-S-K-U-N-K.com.
Right.
And there will be links on our Facebook page and our Twitter feed.
And when you kickstart with them, tell them that we did it.
Yes.
Tell them that it's
because Linoleum Knife sent
we were so convincing to you that you couldn't not give your money.
That's right.
That's our sponsor.
Woo!
Thanks, sponsor.
Thank you, I was a teenage were-skunk.
Now, Tusk.
No, Tombstones.
No, Tusk. Because that is a movie where someone turns into an animal.
Oh, that's true. You're right.
Yeah.
Nice segue.
Thank you.
So, yeah, this is Kevin Smith's latest film. Apparently grew out of a discussion on his podcast. They had read some Craigslist story.
It's a goof that became an extended
An actual movie.
That became a real movie.
So basically Justin Long stars as a podcaster, kind of an obnoxious one, and he travels to...
Well, the whole point of his show is that...
They goof on weirdos.
They goof on weirdos and, you know, people who, you know, are make funnable.
Yes.
And so they go around, you know, interviewing people who are freaks and weirdos and laughing at them.
He travels to Manitoba to talk to a kid who has shot a viral video in which he, remember the Star Wars kid where the guy was like waving around the thing like it was a lightsaber?
Yeah.
This is a kid who's waving around a samurai sword like he's in Kill Bill and slices his own leg off.
Yes.
So, he apparently gives them an exclusive interview because he's a fan of their dumb podcast. So he gets up to Manitoba only to find out that, oops, this sad child has killed himself.
Yeah.
So he decides he don't want to waste the trip. He wants to find some other wacky person to interview. He finds a notice tacked up in a men's room about an elderly gentleman who's basically offering a free room to someone with whom he can share his stories of his seafaring life. So he travels about an hour and a half out of town to this this spooky manor called Pippi Hill, right?
Something like that, yeah.
And the old guy in question turns out to be played by Michael Parks,
right,
who starred in Smith's Red State. And as
and
he's
Tarantino
and he's
used
been,
him as well.
Yeah, he was in Grindhouse and various things. He's been around for ages. He was the then Cam Bronson guy.
Character actor. All long time ago.
Yeah. So anyway, so he starts telling Justin Long these stories about being at sea, and Justin Long doesn't realize that his tea has been drugged, and the only thing in Michael Parks' life that was ever showed him any kindness was a walrus, and so he starts the process of turning Justin Long into a walrus.
This is the plot of...
That's what this movie is about.
This is the entire plot of The Human Centipede. The scientist in The Human Centipede, the girls knock on his door because they're lost in the woods in Germany. And he gives them drinks, and that drugs them. So after they're drugged, he centipedes them.
But not because a centipede was kind to him, right?
Well, no, he has this dream of recreating... he had already done it to three of his dogs.
Ah.
And you see a picture of the dogs that he has, you know, turned into a human doggy-pede.
Mm-hmm.
In the film, he calls it My Sweet Little Three Dog. Then he does it to the people.
So, yeah, the upside is that Justin Long does not have his mouth sewn to anyone's anus, but that's about the only... plus in this arrangement. It's really horrifying.
You didn't like this.
I did not like this
more than you did.
I am a Kevin Smith fan.
You were gay for Smith
for some time,
even before I was.
Yeah,
like your fandom of Smith far surpassed my own. I've always enjoyed his films.
Mm-hmm.
But you've always been a big fan.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say starting from about Chasing Amy, I've really been into his stuff. I like his sense of humor. I like the sexual commentary of his films. I know a lot of gay people are annoyed with Chasing Amy and stuff like that, but I think that he really gets it as somebody whose work makes fun of and comments on the strangeness of human sexuality in general.
Well, the minutiae of human silliness all over the way.
That he just includes gays and lesbians under that umbrella in a very equal way, which I find refreshing and you know, equanimous. Yes. And so, you know, and I think of late, you know, and I was even one of the few critics that gave Cop Out a decent review. I thought it was entertaining.
I thought Cop Out was funny.
I thought it was funny. And so I think, you know, because obviously Judd Apatow...
Even he disavows Cop Out.
Yeah, pretty much. Judd Apatow has pretty much kind of bitten his rhyme as far as the kind of, you know, motor mouth pop culture man-child movie.
Well, Kevin Smith is where Judd Apatow came from.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just... And Judd Apatow has said so.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. I'm not breaking any news here.
No.
But, you know, so I can see why Smith maybe wanted to try other stuff. And I Red State, I thought, was sort of a noble attempt that didn't quite work. And
that
this
is
one,
the one... I haven't seen that one, and I haven't seen Jersey Girl.
Ah.
Yeah.
Well, I've talked about my Jersey Girl thing.
You have talked
show.
About Jersey Girl many times.
I won't go into that. But anyway... Red State, I thought, okay, noble effort, didn't really work for me, but I could see what he was trying to do, and there were some interesting ideas. And this one just felt like this weird mishmash of stuff, and the funny stuff wasn't funny, which surprised me, because I always think, you know, if nothing else, the funny stuff with him is funny. The scary stuff isn't scary. I wasn't sure how we were supposed to take this in terms of the tone is so all over the place, you're not ever sure, does he mean it? Is he goofing on this? Is this supposed to be satirical or poignant or just weird? I don't know what. And then there is a movie star in this movie working under a pseudonym, playing a character named Guy Lapointe. Yeah, who is a Quebecois police investigator.
Yeah.
And
who doesn't do anything
particularly useful. Yeah. And I found him painfully unfunny. I was all right with him. I thought it was trying so hard to basically be Peter Sellers' Clouseau character, but just so overdone and hammy and with the fake nose and the stupid accent and the just not funny. And these scenes went on and on and on. And I did not have fun at this movie. I didn't think it worked. I didn't even think, with Red State, I saw what it was trying to achieve, and maybe it didn't quite get there. This movie, yeah. I don't even know what it wanted to be. I don't know that it knew what it wanted to be. It just was a mess to me.
First of all, I like any movie where mad scientists turn people into weird stuff.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And as a well-documented fan of Human Centipede, I was on board for this. I'm especially on board for the walrus suit that they got, that they made
mm-hmm.
for Justin Long. Because he looks creepy and crazy.
Well, what's weird is that there, in this movie, you have the walrus suit that the guy who is turned into a walrus wears. There is also a walrus suit that someone in the movie who is not turned into a walrus
wears. Yes.
That is, anyway.
Also, it's even grosser.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was a big fan of the makeup effects.
Uh-huh.
I did not know who the secret big name actor was until the closing credits.
Oh.
Because the closing credits say that Guy Lapointe is played by Guy Lapointe.
Right.
But there's somebody else in the cast whose name will tip you off to who Guy Lapointe actually is. It's not hard.
No.
And honestly, going back and thinking about who, watching him on camera, I should have known who it was. Did you figure it out while you were watching
about midway through? I was like, oh, okay.
I should have figured it out. Like, I wasn't really even thinking that I was supposed to be looking for someone
mm-hmm.
who was...
You just thought it was some weird character
actor. I just thought it was some weird character actor that they found. And, but then, as the film went on, I thought, wait, is this someone that... And then the credits rolled, and I thought, oh, I know, I see who that was.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm with you on the tone situation. Tonally, it's weird. Like, the mix of comedy and horror is sort of muddled.
Did you think the comedy was funny?
Sometimes. There were some funny bits that I laughed at. And especially with... his daughter, Harley Quinn Smith,
yes.
as a convenience store clerk.
Right. That was the best scene in the movie.
That was actually my favorite bit in the movie.
You know, which also included the one obligatory Degrassi reference.
Yes. And so, I enjoyed myself. Yeah. I had an okay time watching this, and I
wish I had. I'm not.
I want him to go and do something. You know, I want him to go off in a bold new direction. I want him to incorporate what he's best at
mm-hmm.
into this bold new direction. He is best when he is being a sort of minimum wage Eric Rohmer, where everyone is just talking and talking and talking about the dumbest things imaginable, but it's actually fairly smart.
Right.
That's what I like. That's what I've always liked best about Smith.
Yeah.
And I am not part of this Kevin Smith backlash, which I have seen on the internet quite a lot recently. Mm-hmm. I am still a fan. And I want him to keep going. I want him to keep making movies. And if he wants to make horror movies and other freaky genre films, then I want him to do that.
I'm not disavowing the movies by him.
And I wanted to figure out how to incorporate what he's really good at into that.
I agree. And I think that he would have some interesting things to say about our generation aging, frankly. Yes. Because so much of his work is about the arrested development of
yes.
of our culture. You know, I mean, I think ours, you know, the boomers kind of started it, but really, I think with the Xers is where the whole notion of...
I don't believe in generational labels anymore. You just said boomers and Xers, but I don't believe in that anymore.
I think they apply to a certain extent.
I believe that those are marketing terms.
Fine.
I believe that those are used to sell us things.
For people who are our age, who are...
And it leads to people segregating themselves by age.
Okay, fine, yeah. Marshall McLuhan. for people who are barking at or already up the tree of 50, we're one of the first generations that
planted the tree of 50.
That has not only not given up the culture of our childhood, but still sort of vigorously defends it, even as adults.
I don't vigorously defend.
You don't, but I think a lot of people our age do. And I think the people younger than us...
Rewatching every episode of The Partridge Family recently has...
disavowed you of that.
Has helped me.
Yeah, but people like those 90s kids...
Right.
They're doing it like crazy.
Well, yeah, because it's their turn.
Exactly.
It's their turn to do it.
I'm just saying, I think that Smith, who's a really smart, dead-on kind of cultural observer, would have interesting things to say about that generation aging...
Yeah.
And becoming parents, and I don't know if Jersey Girl sort of scared him away from doing any more movies about parenting, but you know, I think I don't know. I think he's got more stuff to tell, and I respect him as an artist. This movie did not work for me, but I, you know, will go to the next one eagerly and with anticipation.
A Walk Among the Tombstones.
Yes.
Go.
I'm recapping everything.
No, I did Maze Runner.
Fine.
Yeah.
But I did every other one. Okay, Walk Among the Tombstones.
Would you like to flip a coin?
No, I'll do it.
Would you like to draw straws?
I'll do it. Too late now.
Isn't this just the most organic way to do it? With you doing it whenever I tell you to do it? I think that is really
the
best way.
Well, the other thing is that you get plots wrong.
Who cares? Honestly.
I care.
Who cares if the plot isn't always right?
So Liam Neeson, it is a Liam Neeson movie, which is I think now a new subgenre.
Yeah.
I pretty much clearly say,
yeah.
Plays a former Boston cop who is now sober and works as an unlicensed PD and or PI or whatever, and gets hired by a skeevy drug dealer played by Dan Stevens of
Downtown Abbey,
to find his kidnapped wife because he's not really in a position to call the cops. And in investigating the drug kingpin's wife's disappearance, he starts up realizing there's a pattern of these guys who are basically targeting drug guys, taking their money, and then doing awful, awful things to the people they kidnap. So he takes on the case, winds up working with this sort of savvy, but at the same time, what do we think about this kid, the teenage kid that he's working with? Is he?
Oh, he's a literary device.
Well, yeah. He's kind of a savant. He's kind of on the spectrum. I wasn't clear what the deal with him was.
I don't think that... No, there's no spectrum involved.
I didn't really buy the character.
You say that a lot about characters and people.
I didn't necessarily buy the character, but the performance is really good. This actor named Astro... what's his last name? He's also on a new show. He's on Red Band Society.
Oh, is he?
Yeah. Anyway, his performance was good enough to kind of make me buy this character. You're right, that is otherwise totally a just device.
He's a homeless teenager who lives in the library, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
And shows Liam Neeson how to use computers. This is very much an R-rated, grim, you know, like...
It's part noir, part horror film.
Astro Bradley.
Serial killer kind of movie.
Yeah.
And it is absolutely unlike the films that have made Liam Neeson recently a box office draw.
Neeson gets that scene where he gets on the phone and tells the other guy that I'm going to get...
I did write that down. I thought, ooh, he's on the phone!
Yeah.
But that's not the point of the movie.
Like, if he did a period piece, they'd have to put him on, like, you know... he'd have to, like, tell the town operator to connect him with the next thing. And then, like, 10 minutes later when his call comes through, I'm going to kill you.
This is not an action film. This is a mystery. It is a...
It's a procedural.
It is a procedural. It is a... And the noir elements are all over the place. It's incredibly atmospheric. It's dark. It's rainy. It's cold. It's half of the stuff happens at night.
Right.
It has a very sort of somber, downbeat quality. And it's funny, as I watched it, I felt like uncomfortable, like things weren't really working. And I remember walking out of the movie, Ingu was with me, and I don't think she liked it very much, and she was with a friend whose name I'm completely blanking on right now. And we were talking, and he didn't like it, and I walked away from the film not knowing if I really liked it. And the more I kept thinking about it, and then I started writing about it, I thought, no, that was cool. And then this other part was interesting. And the more I thought about it, the more I wrote about it, the more I thought, oh, no, I like this quite a bit. I was into this.
Yeah, it gets under your skin in a satisfying way, I think.
Yeah. It's an ugly...
Yeah.
Not ugly looking, but it's an ugly feeling movie.
It's an ugly glimpse of the worst of humanity.
One of the things I said in my review was that lately serial killers in pop culture have become highly entertaining. They've become much more baroque and much more...
What Bret Easton Ellis, when I was on his show, called the dexterization of serial
people
killers.
People like Dexter or Hannibal, which I think is a wonderful show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they conduct elaborate games with their pursuers and with their victims, and
right.
You know, they leave artisanal clues. You know, it's a way to counteract the fear of a serial killer. You get the audience almost on the side of the serial killer. You want the story to keep going, therefore you want the serial killer to keep killing.
Right. This is the anti-Henry.
And as much as I dig that approach to the serial killer lifestyle, I liked this movie because the serial killers were disgusting and awful.
The worst.
And one of them mundane.
One of them is played by David Barber, who just is...
Harbour.
Harbour, right, Barber. Sorry. David Harbour, who just is just instantly irritating. Like, it took me a while, even on the newsroom, to not just go, ugh, him, because he always plays this guy.
Yeah. I'm on that weekly thing syndicated, Overnight America.
Uh-huh.
And John Grayson, who's the host, he said, that's the kind of guy who you look at, somewhere you think, well, that's a handsome guy. And then you think, that handsome guy wants to murder me. And that is, he's got that sneering kind of face. What's interesting about these guys, though, the killers, the minute the movie sort of incorporates them into the tapestry of characters, you get to see their lives. And it's this very sort of mundane, sort of psychopath kind of life where they're, you know, they get up in the morning and they make biscuits for breakfast and they walk around the kitchen in their underwear and they sort of read the paper.
It's very sort of non
the
special.
Film,
like,
the film even
house.
Goes so far as to suggest that they might be a couple.
They flirt with that a bit.
They flirt with that idea. They never state it explicitly.
They're very domestic.
Yeah. And that's weird. And I wish actually that they had pushed that a little harder. I would have loved it if they had been a gay couple of psychopathic serial killers. That would have made my day.
Of course, all their victims are women, but also this is a movie where all the women are victims.
Right. Yeah, this is a world without women.
Yeah.
There are no female characters in this film. But it's a movie that is in love with films of the past. You can feel, like, elements of The Godfather in the way it looks. There's so many shout-outs to, or shouts-out, I guess, to Laura.
Sure.
The drug trafficker's girlfriend who's missing, or wife who's missing.
Yeah, we never see her except in this
portrait,
giant portrait.
Yeah, and they keep giving it close-ups of the portrait, just like in Laura. So it's got a lot going on. It might not always gel together perfectly, but the more I think about it, the more I might go back and watch it again someday. It's the kind of movie where murder is ugly and horrible.
Yeah, it's and taken it seriously.
It makes you feel bad by the time it's over.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I liked it too. And it, I mean, liked it in that I found it unsettling and creepy, but it was very, I'll tell you, it was fascinating.
The ookiest scene in the entire film is when the killers spot their next victim. And it's this, what, like 14-year-old girl.
Oh, right.
In a bright red coat.
Mm-hmm.
And this otherwise very gloomy
film
atmosphere.
That's like the one pop of color in the entire movie.
It's like the girl in the red coat in Schindler's List. You know, it's you.
And there's like a Donovan song playing. Right?
She, yeah, and she is in slow motion walking across the street, and she kind of waves to them innocently, and you can't help but think, oh, it's this Little Red Riding Hood sort of thing, and they're the wolves, and this is really prurient and nasty. This whole scene, they shoot her like Phoebe Cates coming out of the pool in Fast Times at Ridgemont High. That's sort of like
ski factor.
Get a load of her, you know, like, and she's young. It's nasty.
But it's not, but not in a way that it's prurient or...
Oh, yeah, it is.
Well, but...
You're seeing it from their perspective.
Right, but it's not...
The movie doesn't this about her. The killers do,
right,
and you're seeing
no.
it from their perspective.
Yeah, I just want to delineate the difference. Like, we're asked to look at her in the way that the killers are looking at her, but the movie isn't going,
it's
the movie is going, ew.
Yeah, it's as though you're watching the deaths from the point of view of Michael Myers in the first Halloween.
Sure.
You know, you are uncomfortably put into the position of being the murderer.
Right.
So it's all about unsettling you.
Very much
from
so.
Start to finish. So this is not a normal Liam Neeson kills the bad guys movie.
No.
At all.
And he is very much a flawed character. I mean, building, you know, he was playing a recovering alcoholic in Nonstop, and here even more so. Like, he goes to a lot of 12-step meetings.
Yeah.
You go with him to those meetings.
It's set in 1999.
Right, so it's kind of this pre-apocalyptic...
They people are worrying Y2K.
I said Boston before. It's New York.
It's New York.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I
wondered why you said Boston.
I said Boston because I was thinking about...
Well, maybe I got it wrong.
No, because I was thinking about the Equalizer.
Equalizer,
which we'll talk about next week. New York, sorry.
Preview, by the way, Equalizer is a blast. It's
next time.
Equalizer
next
time, is so awesome.
We'll talk about that.
Where were we?
It's
set in 1999. Everyone's worried about Y2K, but the film has this air of foreboding where you're really, when they're talking Y2K, you're thinking, oh, y'all are about to have 9/11 in a couple of years.
Right.
You know, and it's as though the film feels that coming.
See it.
Totally enjoyable.
Yeah. Bring the kids. Don't.
This is where I leave you.
Oh God.
This
is where I roll my eyes and make a gagging face.
Okay, so Tina Fey.
Yes.
Jason,
what happens in this one, Dave?
Jason Bateman, Corey Stoll, and Adam Driver are siblings, three brothers and a sister. Jane Fonda is their mother. Their father has just died. The mother calls the kids back home along with their spouses and whatever. And even though the father was an atheist Jewish man, the mother says that his dying request was that the kids come and sit Shiva. Now, Shiva is a 7-day mourning ritual with Jewish folks where you sit in these chairs and people, you receive visitors all week long.
Yeah, although now I always thought you had to sit on these like uncomfortable boxes and you cover all the mirrors in the house.
You are supposed to cover the mirrors.
They didn't do that in this movie.
I went to a Shiva website.
Ah,
it was explaining. I looked at it.
Of course, there's a Shiva website.
There's a website that tells you how to do Shiva.
Mm.
And just to cover the mirrors. Like, I mean, obviously, there are many different ways that you can, you know,
and these are some
this.
Super suburban reformed Jews here, so.
They're not just reformed, they're non-observant.
Yeah.
They don't.
As you used to call our friend David Zeev, they are Jack Jews. Like the Jack Mormons.
Like the Jack Mormons, yeah. And so they do that, and they all hate each other. And then they bicker and they say funny things and they do funny things. And then at the end, they hug it out. And I shouldn't even say at the end they hug it out. They hug it out.
Two-thirds.
All of the way.
Yeah.
Every a lot other, of hugging. There's so many scenes that just stop the movie to have a special tender moment of feelings. Because the film has a lot of characters and a lot of little subplots. And they all have to be resolved, and they all have to be resolved warm-heartedly.
Except that some of them aren't.
And what are you talking about?
Well, like, for example, the whole relationship between Tina Fey and the boy next door, who she used to be in love with until they were in an accident and he got brain damage, played by Timothy Oliphant. Like, that never made any sense to me, and that was never resolved in a way that felt like it was a resolution.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so I don't know. I mean, yes, you're right. This is a super pat, and a lot of it is, you know. But that one, for instance, just sort of didn't go anywhere. And there are some other ones that just sort of get brought up and don't really get resolved.
The funny stuff. The funny stuff is funny, but the funny stuff has nothing to do with the resolution to these conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
That's a problem.
Yeah.
The humor is not about the situation necessarily. The humor is this really great cast that's working really hard
to sell this material.
To sell this material by making lots of, you know, jokes that I assume were in the script, but I'm also assuming a lot was improv'd.
Yeah. The script was written by the guy
who wrote the novel.
Who wrote the novel, who apparently is also the creator of Banshee.
Yeah. Jonathan Trotter.
Yeah, and it's directed by Sean Levy, who is the worst director working today. Or one of them.
Worse than the guy who directs the Adam Sandler movies. Worse than Dennis Dugan.
He's top 10 worst.
Okay.
He's the guy behind the Pink Panther remakes and the Night at the Museum movies and Date Night and...
I didn't hate Date Night. It wasn't great, but it was, again, it had funny stuff.
This movie is not nearly as smart or funny as it should be given the people who are in it.
Right. You expect a certain level of
competence and crackle.
Here's my other problem. In fact, I think this is my major problem with the movie. These people have nothing to complain about.
Pretty much.
None of them. They were raised in absolute comfort and privilege. This is evidenced by the
beautiful home.
The beautiful home. Their mother was a famous writer. And you're supposed to believe that all four of them are mortified by the fact that they have a famous writer mother.
Because she's written because about she's them written about in detail them. And their childhoods and stuff. She's a therapist.
You would grow up sort of used to that.
Yeah.
And not freaked out by that. If in real life, you wouldn't become 35 years old and be like, man, you embarrass me, yeah. Mom.
Madonna's kids are over the fact that she's Madonna.
Right.
That's just, you know.
So there's that. It is never once anything less than understood that both Jane Fonda and the father adored those kids and raised them well and raised them to be, you know, creative and open and smart and decent. And yet, all four of these siblings are
carry these resentments
mean
around.
And bitter to each other, and they resent each other for what? They resent Jane Fonda for what? There's no good reason other than petulance and whining.
Meanwhile, you've got Rose Byrne.
Who's magical.
She is...
Utterly magical.
She is... I know Nathan Rabin wants us to retire Manic Pixie Dream Girl, but she's a Manic Pixie Dream Girl. She's
basically,
you know, she never left the hometown. She's there waiting for Jason Bateman.
And she looks like Rose Byrne.
And she's got all the answers and all the quirks and...
She says all the right emotionally intuitive things to Jason Bateman.
I mean, she's giving it her all. I'm not blaming Rose Byrne, but the character's so... Such a crock.
Yeah.
You know, Connie Britton. I mean, like, just...
I dug her.
She's terrific. All these really great actors.
Adam Driver was funny.
Given nothing to do.
Yeah, it's a drag.
I was saying that it's the kind of movie that I would have seen when I was 11 and thought that I was seeing something really,
really
mature,
sophisticated,
and deep, you know. Yeah. And then you watch it again when you're an adult and you're like, oh my God, this movie is a sitcom.
Here's my other beef. We've discussed this before. Mm-hmm. We've discussed this several times over the course of this now...
nearly 4 years
old. Four-year-old show. Jane Fonda cannot wash a dish by hand. Filmmakers, makers of I Was a Teenage Were-Skunk, please pay attention to this.
Get a housekeeping wrangler for your movie stars.
It doesn't matter who you cast in your film. Teach them how to wash a dish properly if you're going to have a scene of them standing at a sink washing a dish.
If Kim Basinger is going to push a vacuum cleaner?
Anytime, exactly.
Coach her on how to push a vacuum
cleaner. Coach Kim Basinger on how to push a vacuum cleaner. Which she could not properly do in that movie with Charlize Theron. Yes. Where I can never remember the
blazing
title.
Something.
Something, the burning.
Burning plane.
The burning something.
Truth.
The burning itch.
Something.
Something with Charlize Theron where Kim Basinger played her mom and was trying to vacuum a rug. And it's, I wish I had it on a loop.
It's like Al Pacino dancing and cruising.
Yes. Every time an unimaginative director places characters in a kitchen, what should they be doing in a kitchen? Well, they should be washing dishes. It's easier than showing them cooking, because if you show them cooking, you have to reset up
continuity.
The stuff for continuity. If you show them washing dishes, that's easier because they could just put the plate back in the water. But nobody, no famous person, no famous movie star in a movie knows how to wash a dish in a movie. And no one is paying attention. These people have long since stopped washing their own dishes.
If they ever did.
Yeah. So you see them sort of rub their hand a little bit on the dish. And then,
Take it out of soapy water and put it on the rack.
Take it out of soapy water and put it on the rack. Or take it out of the soapy water and then dunk it into another tub of water, into another, like the other half of the sink is full of water. Like, that's going to rinse it. In reality, that's just going to make that other sink full of soapy water again.
You know who they should hire?
Me.
No.
I would be a great
you know,
kitchen consultant.
You know who else they should hire?
Who?
The home comforts lady.
Yes.
The author
Even better.
Of
yeah.
Home Comforts.
Go hire the author of Home Comforts.
She knows how to wash a dish.
She knows how to wash a dish. No one's going to understand what we're talking about.
She's one of the greatest Martha Stewart guests of all time.
Obsessive dishwasher lady, who is my hero.
Yeah, she was high strung about the dishes.
She taught me things about washing the dishes.
We still need to get that book.
By hand. Oh, yeah, we do. Jane Fonda cannot wash a dish.
No.
And the next time I see Jane Fonda...
Hey!
Hey! Well, I did see her last year at the Cecily Brown opening at Gagosian.
Oh, okay.
I went to the opening of the Cecily Brown show at Gagosian here in Beverly Hills. Jane Fonda was there. She brushed right up against me holding her little dog. And I turned and I saw who it was. I was like, holy crap, it's Jane Fonda.
Hey, Fonda, your dishwashing skills are lackluster.
Next time I'm at Gagosian and there's an opening and Jane Fonda's there, I'm like, I got to tell you something. Don't wash dishes in movies unless you... rehearse with the Home Comforts lady. She wrote Home Comforts. I can't remember her name. Go find that book. She'll teach you.
She's a genius.
It's probably just in the book. Yeah.
Moving on.
Space Station 76.
Space Station 76.
I have not seen Space Station 76.
Oh, man. 76. I so want you to see this movie.
I will.
Really think you're going to like it. It was closing night at Outfest this year.
I know I will like it, and here's why I know I will like it. They're showing it this week at CineFamily.
Yes.
And if CineFamily is showing it, that means it is of interest. They have excellent curatorial skills.
Yeah, true.
And we know Jack, the
Plotnick,
the director.
Co-writer and
Jack
director.
Jack Plotnick, the co-writer and director of this film. We know him. I know you were talking to him the other day about the film. And one thing you need to say to him... unless he happens to be listening to this episode, having your movie at CineFamily is sort of like a very cool thing to have.
No, you're right. You're right. Yeah. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah.
This movie is really wonderful because it is full of surprises, because it's not the movie that you expect when you hear it described to you or when you start looking at some of the stills. It is set in the 70s idea of the future that never quite happened. So the sets are very Space 1999, silent running, you know, kind of long, curvy white hallways and... You know, but all, with a dash of sort of 70s suburban, like, you know, sunken living rooms and shag carpeting thrown in. And the captain of the space station is played by Patrick Wilson, who is drunk and angry, and we come to find out why. His new second-in-command is Liv Tyler, and he is not down with having a woman working under him. She can't have children, but winds up bonding with the very unhappy child of a couple played by Matt Bomer and Marissa Coughlin. He has a robot hand. She has a pill addiction. Anyway, so yeah, the thing is, like, this movie, it has all the trappings of a parody. Like, you're expecting it to be Galaxy Quest or Spaceballs or something. But then it actually has these sad characters and their little dramas working out. And the movie takes those dramas and those characters completely seriously. So, you know, whoever described it as a cross between, you know, Space 1999 and The Ice Storm was kind of onto something. and it's so well acted and so just the pitch perfect in terms of the way things look, the way people behave, like the smoking, you know, and you know, for a movie that was made for 2 cents, I mean, the set designs are gorgeous. Our friend Billy Brooks did the special effects.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. And it looks amazing. It's such a smart, weird movie, and it's constantly challenging you because you think it's going to go left and it goes right. And it has a tone that is very much unpredictable, but it totally works. You know, it's not like Tusk where you don't know where it's coming or going. This movie, you know, you can tell it's of a piece. You can tell it was designed to be the way it is, even if the way it is isn't always the comfortable direction.
Right.
And it's really funny, but it also, you know, it you do care about these characters and how things turn out for them. It's just great. I'm so impressed with Jack for having made this movie, and I really hope people see it. It's playing this week in Los Angeles at CineFamily. It's in New York at the Quad. I think it might be in Chicago and a couple other cities. It will be available on demand starting this Tuesday, the 23rd, and then next Tuesday, the 30th, it comes out on DVD. So wherever you are, you can already see this movie or you can see it really soon. I super highly recommend it. I really, really love Space Station 76.
Well, it's good that you did, because when you know people who make a movie,
if I knew people who made a movie and I didn't like it, I would not talk about it. But I'm talking about it because it's great. DVD picks.
The Last of the Unjust.
Okay. And for people who missed the episode when you reviewed that one, what is it?
It's from Claude Lanzmann, who is the director of Showa. And when he made Showa, it was, you know, the 70s.
He shot in the 70s.
He shot so much footage that since Showa, he has used that accumulated footage to make several documentaries. Each of them fascinating and devastating. You know, Showa is the masterpiece, and probably the greatest documentary I've ever seen. And I've talked about this before. The Last of the Unjust is it's almost 4 hours long. I think it's 3 hours and 45 minutes. It's an interview, a series of interviews he did with Benjamin Mermelstein, who was the only, what they called, the elder of the Jews not to have been killed during the war. And he was in the Theresienstadt ghetto. And there are people who after the war, sort of thought of him as, you know, a collaborator. And so this is a nearly four-hour film of just interviews with him where he talks about, you know, all of the things he had to do to survive and to save people's lives. And sometimes that meant participating in, you know, stuff the Nazis
propaganda films
demanded that he participate in. So it is, it's incredible. Claude Lanzmann is 87 years old now. And some of the footage in this is new, where he's sort of walking through the old ghetto area. I saw it at the Royal with art film bro Matt.
Yes,
and it's incredible. It's worth the sit down and the watch that it will take. This is get all the way through it.
This is a big DVD week for films that we have raved about on the show this year.
Ida comes out this week,
yeah. And We Are the Best.
And We Are the Best.
My DVD pick this week is actually Criterion is releasing Roman Polanski's Macbeth.
Ooh.
Which is, yeah.
You just got a ooh
it is ooh worthy. It is a very powerful film. One of the most sort
it's
of...
It's the most brutal Macbeth
there is. He does not
just post-Manson.
Exactly. This was, I think, the first film he made after Sharon Tate's death.
Yeah.
It does not shy away from the more brutal aspects of the play.
Yeah.
It is vibrant and violent and
anguished.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary movie, and people have not seen it. Like it's one of the lesser seen of his films.
That's my understanding. Yeah.
Yeah. So Criterion is putting it out, and whenever Criterion puts something out, they do it upright. So
yeah,
if you've never seen Polanski's Macbeth, or if you've seen it on like a crappy VHS or whatever, definitely you'll want to pick up the Criterion collection version of it. We have letters. Do we not?
We do. Here they are. Hi, guys. I figured I'd contribute to your now empty mailbox. My husband and I watched Terrence Davis's The Long Day Closes tonight. And earlier this week, we watched Scorsese's Who's That Knocking at My Door, which I've never seen.
I've never seen that one either.
And Mean Streets. So it's been a great week for personal movies from filmmakers who love movies and music, which leads me to two questions for you. What are some of your favorite movies about movies?
Mm-hmm.
And two, what are some of your favorite uses of music in movies?
Okay.
This is from Katie, by the way.
Those are two big questions.
Long-time listener, Katie.
Yes. Movies about movies. Singing in the Rain, of
course. Day for Night.
Day for Night. Yeah. Beware of a Holy Whore. The Bad and the Beautiful. Seriously.
Yes. No, I know.
Yeah, those are the ones that
lead to... Valley of the Dolls.
The Oscar, yeah. Those are the ones...
Oh, Irma Vep.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Good one. I'd forgotten about that. Yeah, totally Irma Vep.
Which is totally Day for Night.
Pretty much, yeah. Down to the casting of Jean-Pierre Léo.
Yeah.
So, there's quite a few. The favorite uses of music...
Jaws.
Oh, well, sure. I think she means... Music that wasn't composed for the film. She's talking about Mean Streets and Long Day Closes.
You mean like music supervision?
Right.
You know, people who put music in films, songs and stuff like that.
Like Lust for Life at the beginning of Trainspotting? You know,
16 Candles.
Sure.
16 Candles and Pretty in Pink.
Overall.
Score Jaws.
Didn't we find out that the awesome... Modern Love sequence from Francis Ha was actually a ripoff of
Leos
Carax movie.
From
Boy Meets Girl.
Yes.
Yeah. So I liked the Francis Ha one, but now I have to go back and watch the Leos Carax one. Apparently, that he took it from.
Yeah.
The Town Called Malice in Billy Elliot.
Mm. Yeah. True.
Recently, Nothing's Going to Stop Us Now. In the
you know what
films.
I like?
And I'm so excited, and I'm so excited.
You know what I like? I like the Footloose remake.
Where it opens with the Footloose. Who had the
Someone sent us a letter about this very thing. And
now you can't stop thinking about it.
I can't stop thinking about it.
They die to Footloose?
The kids at the beginning of the Footloose remake die to the song Footloose. But even before that had been sort of reignited in my memory, the way they use Let's Hear It for the Boy in the Footloose remake is so
perfect.
Delightful. And I remember seeing it with you on the Paramount lot. And the minute they start doing that, what they do to Let's Hear It for the Boy, you did this. And you can't, no one can see me, but you started clapping your entire hands together. Like, not just applause, but like your whole hand going like, and you did this. You went, You squealed in the middle of a press screening.
I did.
And other film critics turned around. Like, I think it was Christie.
Yeah, I think Wade Major.
Like, turned around and were like, Alonzo.
I was... It just pressed my buttons big time.
It was very sweet and funny the way they used it.
It was lovely.
But, yeah, the kid's all dying to
That is hilarious.
I just cannot stop thinking about that. So, hi, Alonzo and Dave. You mentioned that during Idris Elba's parole hearing in The Drop. No.
No Good Deed.
Not The Drop. No Good Deed. The letter says The Drop. Elba's character is referred to as a malignant narcissist. This is, in fact, a reference to the pilot of Luther.
Oh.
When the title character applies this diagnosis to a suspect. I've never seen an episode of Luther.
I have not either. But don't they call him that like 10 more times over the course of the movie?
They do. It's pretty great.
That's a lot of homage.
Much in the vein of Alonzo's erstwhile... This is a series of little points. Yeah. Much in the vein of Alonzo's erstwhile obligation to gay movies, I feel an obligation to support Quebecois movies, despite the fact that some of them are train wrecks. Since many of my friends do makeup or costumes or what have you for various productions. Recently, Javier Dolan's new movie Mommy opened to some critical acclaim. I hated his last movie and am debating skipping this one despite the good press. Have you heard of this movie? And if so, what is your take? Is this money better spent on, say, The Identical?
Well, you should see The
Identical. I have not seen Mommy yet.
I am really behind on Dolan. Like, I have several... I've had discs of his floating around. I've seen Lawrence Anyways.
Right. And which is the one he's talking about.
No. The one before this one was Tom at the Farm.
Are you sure?
Yes. We showed it at Outfest this year, but I didn't get around to seeing it. Dolan's made like six or seven movies now.
Like,
I've only seen
one.
He's
like 16 years old and he's already made seven movies.
Yeah, and they all play at Cannes.
He makes a movie every month.
Yeah, pretty much. He's the Joyce Carol Oates of 20-something Quebecois filmmakers.
Yeah.
So yeah, I have no idea what to tell you on that one because I'm not up to date with him.
In a past letter, I think I confused you when I characterized Dave's occasionally hilarious incompetence. No, my incompetence is not occasionally hilarious. My incompetence is always hilarious. It's
consistently a riot.
Start the letter at the beginning?
No. It cut off in the middle of consistently a riot for some reason.
Oh, okay. And where did you go back to?
I picked up where we left off.
Oh, okay. All right, so that was just a little glitch there, listeners. You did nothing wrong.
No.
We screwed up a little bit. This computer did something.
The computer is bad.
Anyway, I characterized Dave's occasionally hilarious incompetence with all things technological as chimping. This is a term I invented, referring to actions performed with proficiency typical of a chimpanzee. Dave's adventures with the headphones at the beginning of the most recent episode are a perfect example of him chimping it.
Big chimping.
I thought the significance would be clear, but I guess not. That's right. Big chimping. That's what I am. I like the word chimping.
Chimping, yeah.
It describes a lot of the things that I do. In the course of a day.
It may take the world by storm.
Dennis Hensley made a movie-related poop joke that The Drop was the story of his life. So I wanted to share one that I made recently, which landed surprisingly flat.
A story or a poop?
I don't know.
Okay.
On Saturday mornings, I play recreational hockey, and my tradition is to come to these games as hungover as possible. On this occasion, that means you get drunk every Friday night.
He's Quebecois.
You're an alcoholic. On this occasion, I had also a rather unwholesome late-night meal. The next morning, to explain why I was late for the game, I texted that I was experiencing the poop equivalent of the Letters for Santa scene in Miracle on 34th Street. That's a good one.
That is.
Of the 16 people on the team, ages 21 to 30, not a one got the reference. I was told to stop referencing obscure movies that nobody watched. So no one here has watched. None of your friends have watched Miracle on 34th Street.
I'm sure there's some French-Canadian version about Père Noël they watch instead.
Right. I gather that Dave likes cold, gray places.
Mm-hmm.
You are 1,000% correct. why I live in Los Angeles is a daily mystery.
Oh, irony.
To me. I'm hiding from our beautiful weather almost all the time. Over the next few months, Montreal will fulfill both of those criteria with gusto. I know. Trust me, that 6 months I went to college in London was the happiest days of my life. Every day, cold,
all
wet.
All the damp.
Cold, gray. The sun just never came out. Nonstop steel gray skies and rain. For instance, the sky has now been overcast for two straight days, and the high for today is only about 65 Fahrenheit. You're giving me a chub. Last week we had... I'm fixing to turn into a were-skunk. Last week we had cold drizzle for days on end. If you live on the plateau, and why live anywhere else, really, the walk from your house to your preferred cafe will be just long enough to savor the bleak surroundings without being too uncomfortable. I just mentioned this in passing in case you were looking for a change of scenery. That's all I have for now. Keep up the good work. Rene in Montreal.
Well, now you can always just watch Walk Among the Tombstones again.
Yeah. I mean, if there were a way somehow that listeners to the show could figure out a way to bring a little, like, you know...
horrifying weather.
55-degree bleak overcast grayness to Los Angeles. If you are magic or a witch that knows how to conduct weather spells...
A mystical skunk.
I would like that a lot. It would... like, I feel energized, invigorated... by that kind of weather.
All right.
The sun just bums me out. And seriously.
Are we done or is there more mail?
Well, we've got a YouTube channel that you need to talk
about. Well, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. We have started a YouTube channel, Linoleum Knife. We are posting our old episodes. We posted last week's episode as sort of a test.
Why you would want to listen to these is beyond
me. We're now
me.
Digging back all the way back to November of 2010 when this program began.
Yeah.
And we were even less competent then than we are now.
Yes.
To the extent that you can't even hear those episodes. Like, they're there on YouTube, and if you want...
like, the opening music is very loud,
and then you were like...
and then it's hard to hear us.
Yeah.
So you have to crank your volume up.
Yeah, like you may
really
have to hook
high.
You may have to listen to us on a device, like through a speaker or a television or something, where you can really jam up the volume, because, yeah, you
how
cannot
did we,
hear
how
us.
Did we ever get listeners?
I don't know. It's like we put out, like, the Nothing book in the 70s that was just blank, you know... The Nothing Podcast.
I had forgotten that existed.
The Nothing Book. That was a thing. Yeah. So anyway, check those out if you're feeling it. Subscribe to our channel. Check out our Linoleum Knife.
Start from
group.
The beginning. Count all the number of times I mentioned Robert Bresson from then until now.
We have the Linoleum Knife group page now on Facebook, where folks can have conversations with each other and with us on
sometimes
occasion.
Sometimes with us.
About movies
when we deign to
and
speak
whatnot.
To you.
So hop in there and join the conversation. And, of course, you like our regular Facebook page where we keep you abreast of all kind of things. You can subscribe to this show for free on iTunes. Leave us a nice review, much like the following lovely people who have gone in and given us nice little 5-star write-ups.
This is that part like at the end of that old kid show romper room.
That's right.
You see random names of
and
people.
And I see Drill Dozer and Mike Movie and Blood Clay and JRR 206 and Nighttime 68.
We have a listener named Drill Dozer?
Apparently we do.
That's a great name.
Yeah. So thank you for those 5-star reviews. It does help people find the show, and it helps us on our chart listings on iTunes.
Yeah.
So that's really helpful. You can stream the show at Stitcher Radio or thelounge.com. Follow us on Twitter at LinoleumCast. Check into the show at TVTag.com. Our email address is linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. That's where you can drop us mail with questions, comments, with top 10 lists, bottom 10 lists, funny movie theater stories, whatever other random observations you want to share. It's also the address where you can PayPal us for all the awesome stuff that we sell. Our $20 Linoleum Knife t-shirts, available
right.
in a variety of sizes. Our $1.99 extra episodes, our Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife, where we talk about feature films in detail and at length that you can watch with the movie or on its own if you want. So far we have done...
We're fixing to do the Poseidon Adventure.
We're back to the Poseidon Adventure.
You don't need to list the ones we've already done. You
okay.
can find that on the site.
Yes. You can find all of those at...
That'll probably happen after we come back from Spain.
I think so,
which,
yeah.
by the way... is going to be a thing. We're going to be gone for over a week, and there's not going to be an episode.
We're going to miss one.
Right.
And I might even do one without you with some of my siblings.
Oh, really?
Gorilla style.
Without me.
If you want to, you can.
Why without me?
Because when I make you do a show and we're out of town, you complain endlessly about it.
You're right.
So,
but I should be on it so I can complain.
I would love for you to be on it. It's your call.
You're going to bring the little microphone?
That didn't work for me in France. We just talked into the computer. In Italy, rather. So we'll just do it that way. I really want to get my brother Fernando on this show.
That would be great.
Because he is my movie enabler from the get-go.
True.
So, as always, we thank Blue for our theme music. Check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Check out the B-Movies podcast with Bibbs and Whitney and the Schmoes Know and Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley. Fat Guys of the Movies, the Criterion Cast, Film Spotting SVU, the Brett Easton Ellis podcast, Podcrash, Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. Our numbers have been crazily up of late, which thank you for talking about the show to your friends if you've been doing so, or posting it in your various social media entities. Please keep up the good work. Tell other people that we're doing this stuff, and maybe they'll like it too. Who knows?
They won't like it.
They might.
They're not going to like it.
I don't know. They might like it.
They're not going to like
it. They might like it.
No, they're not.
Anyway, we thank you for listening, and we will catch you next time. We have one more show before we go to Europe.
Bye.